your Dr. Van Vliet. We do have time for some questions, if there are any questions from the floor for our brother. Down here at the front. Yalta.
If I understood you well, particularly at the end there, you said that even if a child is not a believer, he is still a child related to God by creation. How would you then understand the imprecatory psalms and, for example, the fact that at the flood the Lord destroyed all those people that he had created? That's my question.
Yeah. Two aspects to that answer. In the first place, we can't climb up into the mind and the heart of God and fully understand and appreciate how that all works within him. You know, what goes on in the mind and, so to speak, the heart of God in having to punish also so severely the creation that he made? We're always going to be limited in our understanding there. I think of the Belgian Confession, Article 13, we ought not to curiously inquire beyond what our capacity allows. So there's part of the answer is going to have to be, here we reach some of our limits. In addition to that, though, it actually highlights the totality of the fall and the depravity in this way. If human beings, in their sinfulness, were simply sinning against God, the lawgiver, right, that would be already wrong, deep, and sinful, and God as lawgiver has every right to punish in his holiness and righteousness. So we can't say that God did anything wrong in, you know, destroying all these creatures. That was within his righteousness and his holiness. But when you now think of the fact that all of these sinful human beings, you know, as human beings, God knows still that he created human beings to be his children. And now they rebel, they make themselves to be enemies of God. This makes it all the more tragic. Because if one of my own children sins against the government, right, I already say, son, daughter, what are you doing? But if I have taught and cherished that child and brought him up and say, you don't do that, you don't do that, and yet my own son, my own daughter, rebels, it hurts more. And so these human beings that were created with that special privilege are yet rebelling, rebelling, rebellion. It makes the sinfulness of the fall even that much greater, tragic, offensive. Yeah? But yeah, how that all works in the heart and the mind of God, I think then we're going to go beyond what we can understand and beyond what God has revealed.
Question? Yes.
Could you not compare the abortions to the sacrificing of children to Moloch in the Old Testament? Because basically it's a similar sort of sin, because it's they're sacrificing their children or unborn children to their selfish life, so to speak.
I suppose there is some comparison. When they did that, they were doing that because in their twisted, warped understanding, this would be the ultimate sacrifice which would surely please the god Molech and turn his blessing and benefit toward the person who made such a horrendous sacrifice. But that's the way they would have thought of it. By making this ultimate sacrifice of giving one of your own children over, surely this god must be convinced to show favor to you. Obviously, people who are going forward with abortion are not thinking along those lines. But yeah, there may be some selfish motive in it. That's what you're speaking of. But there is, I think, also a fundamental difference, because what people are saying today in society is either that's not person, right? It's not person yet, and therefore there's no obstacle to end the life. This is an abortion. Or this is a human being, this is a person, but their life is not worth living according to some subjective relative standards, and therefore we're justified in putting it to end. The presentation this evening is meant to say that God said in Genesis 9, image of God, that's the reason why not, and therefore that's what we have to keep center. And the society around us won't get this anymore. They won't. But we can show this and show the implications to them, and therefore in that way make the argument against these things in a certain way just by the way we treat, you know, the life in the womb, the way we treat life even when there are difficulties, Down syndrome or other handicaps, and also how we treat life at the end.
Thank you, Dr. Van Vliet. My question, a little bit about the image of God. We see God in the Trinity as well. That's a big part of who God is, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And obviously that's also relational. Can you just maybe just have a talk, let us know a little bit about that and how that affects also our view of the image of God?
Well, thank you for this intriguing question. The question being, since we're created in the image of God, God is triune, so is there some type of threeness in us, is one of the questions that's being asked. And over the years, theologians have given a lot of thought to this, and they've said, well, there is one passage, 1 Thessalonians 3, that speaks about the human being, body, soul, and spirit. So then you have three. And maybe that's a reflection of triune God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, body, soul, and spirit. You're going to run into some very strange thoughts there, right? So you might say, well, spirit and man connected to the spirit of God. Okay. So is the body more connected to the Father or the Son? The soul, things go very strange very quickly. What is revealed, and this puts us on less speculative and more solid ground, is what we read in Colossians chapter 1, verse 15, but then I'll connect it to verse 13 in just a moment. He is the image of the invisible God, speaking not about us, but speaking about Christ. He is the image of the invisible God. And who is that he? In verse 13, he's specifically described as his beloved Son. So, his beloved Son, verse 14, 15, he is the image of the invisible God. So there's something, I find it wonderful. I find it something that you can't fully comprehend as other things with God. But on the one hand, human beings were created in the image and likeness of God. On the other hand, within the triune Godhead, between the Father and his beloved Son, you can also, scripturally speaking, use the word image. It's right there. So in that relationship between Father and Son, there is the word image, and attached to it, likeness, in full divine likeness. And in being recreated, we are not recreated in the first place, the image of the Spirit or something. We're recreated in the image of the Son, and so restored as true children of the Father. So it is connected, but I would not go in the direction of saying, well, there's three in one in God, therefore there should somehow be three in one in us. Actually, three in oneness, triuneness, is a distinct divine. That's in a category all of its own. That doesn't get kind of reflected into us.
We'll take two more questions, and then we'll end with the questions, because we have to get on to talk about the seminary. So, Brother Wilco, and then Brother Eichelblum.
Good evening. Just a question. I assume that we all agree with your interpretation about the image of God, the value of that, and also that we have to set an example regarding euthanasia and abortion. But I have a task at the moment to convince members of the Labour Party that euthanasia is wrong.
Euthanasia is wrong.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. That they can't make that into a law in WA. What arguments can I use to convince an unbeliever that this is definitely wrong?
Yes. So there can be arguments that you put forward also coming out of what's traditionally called the sanctity of life argument. I'm not at all suggesting that we should jettison that argument. This is an additional argument or antidote. So we can, in some way, try to show that human life is special, sacred, holy. But even there, we have a great uphill battle, because almost everyone that we're talking to in the world is convinced of the theory of evolution. And then what's special really about human life? It's just on the continuum, and you probably know full well, brother, that that's the way the argument goes, right? If an animal is suffering, you put the animal down. So if the human being is suffering, why not end the life? That's the logic, right? And so long as the world keeps thinking in its foundational philosophy on the basis of evolution, we, coming from the point of creation in the image of God, it will always be a very hard argument. And that's why part of what I'm trying to say here is that whatever arguments we can put together, at the end of the day, I think one of the most powerful things is how we're going to show, both at the beginning and the end, how life can be respected as a gift from God.
My question follows up on that point.
Yeah.
How could we do things better? Are we doing things as well as we could? And how can we encourage each other to do better on caring for the unborn, for, let's say, the disabled, and for the elderly?
Let's take one example for both. I'll start with the last one about the movement towards doctor-assisted suicide and those. You might have seen it, I kind of cut it short due to time, but there was a reference to the hospice movement. A movement, and this is not always from Christians, it's sometimes unbelievers, to say there is a way to die and come to the end of this earthly sojourn which can be done without doctor-assisted suicide, but can be very respectful and can also be edifying, helpful. One of the questions I think we should consider is how involved could we and should we be in that hospice movement? What could we do as churches to either be part of that, or maybe this is a service that we would shape up. We, you know, mentally handicapped brothers and sisters, we know how to do this. And maybe we need to get more into the hospice, and then not only for perhaps our own, but also to show others. You know, death can be done in a very respectful way. And who knows what opportunities are there also for spreading the gospel when death is right there before us. On the other side, I've seen good things. I think of ARPA in Canada, and maybe I know there's ARPA Association here, but in this context, they have highlighted in a public and visible way that those who have severe limitations mentally and physically can yet, in the context of family and church life, have a very rich and blessed life, both ways. Those who have the limitations and those who support them and surround them. And they've videoed that, they've put that out there, and I know that also for unbelievers, it's been a very powerful testimony. When they just focus on the limitations and maybe these kind of lives should be ended, and then they see this completely different perspective on it, it's actually very powerful.